looking for answers to questions that I already know. I could build me a castle with memories.
Oh, we'll come down so hard if they do anything to our people. We'll come down so hard, then the gloves are off so beautifully.
President Trump has escalated his rhetoric against Iran, including threatening the country's supreme leader in a social media message.
It's Tuesday, June 17th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The man suspected of killing a Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband and wounding another lawmaker and his wife faces federal and state murder charges.
There has been focus on his religious connections.
There's been a decided uptick in the rhetoric and vision of violence in the United States from apostolic leaders for some time.
Also, how one Kansas town is working to improve quality of life across generations.
And when egg prices skyrocketed, some people rented chickens.
Boom, there we go. We didn't have chickens one day, and then we had a whole setup the next.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A meeting of President Trump's national security team has wrapped up with some indications the administration may be warming to the idea of having the U.S. play a role in Israel's ongoing strikes against Iran. President Trump saying he's interested in something much bigger than a ceasefire, though what exactly that means is not entirely clear. The White House has said the U.S. is not joining Israel's attacks on Iran. Some U.S. assets, including a third U.S. Navy destroyer, have been moved to the region. A second U.S. carrier strike group is headed toward the Arabian Sea. President Trump, meanwhile, says Iran's supreme leader is an easy target, but as NPR's Franco Ordonez reports, Trump says the leader is safe for now.
President Trump took to social media where he's calling for the unconditional surrender from Iran in its conflict with Israel, which is entering its fifth day of exchanging strikes. Trump said, quote, "We have now total and complete control of the skies over Iran." In another post, he said the U.S. knows exactly where the supreme leader is. Quote, "We're not going to take him out, at least for now. But we don't want missiles shot at civilians or American soldiers. Our patience is wearing thin." Franco Ordonez, NPR News, the White House.
New York City Comptroller Brad Lander was arrested in New York immigration court today. As NPR's Amanda Bastillo reports, the Homeland Security Department is alleging he interfered with federal law enforcement.
DHS Assistant Secretary for Media Affairs says Brad Lander impeded on a federal officer. Lander is also a candidate in New York City's mayoral race. The incident was caught on video and shows Lander being pushed by several masked men down a hall. The arrest comes after several other high-profile clashes between Democratic officials and federal immigration officers. Earlier this month, Senator Alex Padilla was forcibly removed and briefly handcuffed by federal law enforcement after interrupting a Los Angeles press conference by Homeland Security Secretary Christine Ohm. And Newark Mayor Ross Baracus was arrested while accompanying Democratic Congress members to visit an immigration detention center in New Jersey. Ximena Bustillo, NPR News.
A bigger-than-expected drop in retail sales last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on the latest spending data from the Commerce Department.
Retail spending dropped by nearly a full percentage point in May. Some of that drop was expected after an earlier surge in spending on big-ticket items as shoppers rushed to get ahead of tariffs. Spending at gas stations was also down during the month thanks to a drop in gasoline prices. That trend could be changing now as fighting between Israel and Iran pushes pump prices higher. AAA says the average price of regular gas rose about 3 cents a gallon overnight. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks slumped amid concerns about the escalating conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Iran and the weaker retail sales numbers. The Dow fell 299 points today. The Nasdaq dropped 180 points. You're listening to NPR. Senate lawmakers are voting on a new form of cryptocurrency known as stable coins, which basically ties crypto to the U.S. dollar. The bill, the first of what is expected to be a wave of cryptocurrency-friendly legislation under the current administration. While the measure has advanced with bipartisan support, some Democratic members are concerned the measure does little to address the president's own financial interests in crypto. The measure due to be voted on today would establish guardrails and consumer protections for stable coins. Kraft Heinz says it will be removing all artificial food dyes from products sold in the U.S. by the end of 2027. San Pedro's Maria Godoy reports the company also says it will stop making new products with those dyes effective immediately.
In a statement, Kraft Heinz said nearly 90% of its U.S. products are already free of synthetic dyes. It says it has invested in removing the dyes in remaining products or replacing them with natural colors. About a decade ago, the company removed the artificial dyes used to give its Kraft mac and cheese its iconic yellow-orange hue. That color now comes from spices like paprika and turmeric. Kraft Heinz says its ketchup has never used artificial dyes. The company's announcement comes nearly 2 months after federal health officials said they would work with the food industry to phase out the use of petroleum-based food dyes. Some studies have linked these dyes to negative effects on children's behavior and mental health. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Oil prices surged again amid the escalating tensions in the Middle East and worries that could affect global supply. Oil was up 4% today to close at $74.97 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
6 minutes after 4 o'clock, thank you for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Wonder Trek Children's Museum has a Pause and Play fundraiser Saturday, June 28th from 10 to 2 at the Babinski Foundation Animal Shelter in Pequot Lakes. Meet adoptable dogs and cats, play, go on a scavenger hunt, and more. Lunch available for purchase. All ages are welcome. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report. Right now, we continue with All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump today called Iran's supreme leader an easy target, but said that he's not looking to, quote, kill him, but that could change. The clear threat against supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is a significant escalation of Trump's position over the last week. He previously had distanced himself from Israeli military action against Iran, but now he is taking some credit. NPR's Franco Ordonez joins us from the White House with the latest. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Franco, I know that the president cut his trip to the G7 summit in Canada short because of this escalating conflict. What has he been doing since?
Yeah, he got back early this morning, and this afternoon he huddled with his national security team in the Situation Room for about an hour. That was after he issued the pointed threats and warnings. Trump said, quote, "We now have total and complete control over the skies over Iran," and called for Iran to unconditionally surrender. Now, this is really a significant escalation in a conflict that now is into its fifth day. On the way back from Canada, reporters on Air Force One actually asked Trump what he wants to see happen now, and he told them he wants something bigger than a ceasefire.
An end. A real end, not a ceasefire. An end.
So something that would be permanent.
Yeah, or giving up entirely. That's okay, too.
Okay, Franco, we've been tracking this, and as I understand it, the president previously was leaning into negotiations rather than military strikes, right?
Yeah, and this is really a significant pivot for Trump. I mean, when Israel launched its strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities last week, the White House emphasized that the U.S. was not involved. But now Trump's suggesting that the U.S. is involved. I mean, he's saying things like, we have total control of the skies. We know where the supreme leader is hiding. I mean, he's taking more ownership. You know, he went on to say that the supreme leader is safe for now, but indicated that that could change if civilians were targeted or American soldiers.
So no more diplomacy then?
No. I mean, it doesn't appear that he is even interested in diplomacy. I mean, he dismissed comments by the French president that Trump left early to seek a ceasefire. I mean, here is more of what Trump said on Air Force One when he was asked about negotiating.
The cities have been blown to pieces. They've lost a lot of people. They should have done the deal. I told them, do the deal. So I don't know. I'm not too much in a mood to negotiate.
Now, he's also saying, though, that he may send Vice President J.D. Vance and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff to negotiate with Iran.
Now, the U.S. has assisted with defense efforts of Israel. What are the chances, do you think, of deeper U.S. involvement?
You know, I mean, that's the big question, and it's the one that was likely the focus of these talks in the Situation Room today. I mean, I will say he's drawing a red line in certain areas with attacks on U.S. soldiers, with civilians, and he's leaving his options open. Now, some of his allies are pushing him to get more involved, such as Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, while other lawmakers, such as Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky, are working to block any U.S. military involvement in the conflict without congressional approval. And just look at what he is signaling in his own words. You know, we this, we that. Again, he is taking ownership. And he says, quote, our patience is wearing thin. He's really blurring the lines of U.S. interests and Israeli interests. These are deliberate choices of words. I mean, it's so different than just what he was offering. I mean, it's very different than just offering Israel support.
That is NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez with the latest. Thank you so much, Franco.
Thank you, Juana.
All right, as we just heard, Israel and Iran have now been trading attacks for 5 days. Among the countries caught in the flight path between the two, Jordan and Lebanon. And people there are coping in different ways, as NPR's Jane Araf reports from Amman.
There's nothing more serious than war, the casualties, the destruction. The danger of being hit by shrapnel from weapons launched up to 1,000 miles away. The Jordanian and Lebanese governments are trying hard to stay out of the conflict. For most of their citizens, there's nothing they can do but watch. And that's exactly what many are doing. This is an extraordinary scene this weekend on a rooftop bar near Beirut. Lebanese musician Alain Otaïk plays saxophone while guests snap photos of Iranian missiles streaking across the sky. In the viral video, he wears a multicolored kimono, and he really leans into the music. We caught up with Otaïk by Zoom.
And at first, I thought it was a firework, and after I realized, no, it's not a firework because everybody was tense. So I decided to continue play and give this love to everyone who's feeling, emotionally disturbed and stuff like this to make them feel good.
Otaïk, whose stage name is O. Allen Sachs, says bars and restaurants in Beirut are mostly still full. He says all the wars Lebanon has been through have made people here a bit different.
Me personally, I live in the moment and be living in the moment and not focusing on what's happening around you with music will help you in this situation, you know what I mean?
Lebanon has been officially in a state of war with Israel for years. Despite a ceasefire in November, Israel is still launching airstrikes against the militant group Hezbollah. Lebanon really wants to stay out of this conflict and in any case has no real air force to speak of. Jordan, helped by U.S. air defenses, has been intercepting Iranian attacks aimed at Israel to minimize the danger to Jordanians. Air raid sirens have sounded several times a day since Israel began attacks on Iran. Jordan has a peace treaty with neighboring Israel. But Israel's war in Gaza against Hamas has killed more than 55,000 Palestinians. And there's no love lost for Israel here. Despite the danger, a lot of Jordanians have been brewing tea and going up on their roofs to watch the missiles when they hear the sirens at night. So many that the government has warned them to stay indoors. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
When egg prices surged to record highs this year, so did the number of people who added egg-laying chickens to their backyard. As many as 11 million households have them, according to the American Pet Products Association. But for those who aren't ready to fully commit, renting is an option. Chicken rental businesses provide everything a person needs, the coop, the food, and the hens. Skylar Rossi with member station Harvest Public Media reports.
It's been just over a week that chickens have been living in Katie Hitt's backyard in St. Louis. And on this day, the four multicolored birds cluck as they snack on a treat of dried mealworms, which Hitt is shaking into the run of their coop. She and her family have enjoyed the pale blue eggs the hens lay, and her three young kids are having fun with the birds.
That's the first thing they're thinking of when they wake up in the morning is like, how are the chickens and what are they doing?
Local regulations for backyard chickens vary across the country. Hitt can only keep hens, not a rooster, in her backyard, and they must stay contained. She had wanted the birds for a while, but she was nervous about doing something wrong. She didn't know anyone with a backyard flock and was overwhelmed by the amount of advice online.
I'm looking at coops, I'm looking at food, I'm looking at all these things, and I just wasn't sure what the right move would be.
But then had heard about chicken rentals. She could have her birds and coop delivered right to her home, expert advice, and only a one-year commitment. And renting was quick.
It was just like, boom, there we go. We didn't have chickens one day, and then we had a whole setup the next.
People flocked to get backyard chickens this year. Rent the Chicken, a national backyard rental business, opened over a decade ago. Co-founder Jen Tompkins says in some of their regions, all of their birds were rented by early May, which was unusual.
We've been so busy, we haven't even been able to compare numbers now versus last year. When we looked in February, we were already about 20% ahead on this year versus last year this time.
Hatcheries say they were also flooded with orders. Some point to the recent expensive egg prices and shortages as the reason why.
Things exploded, and it's almost 100% to do with eggs, and the cost of eggs specifically.
That's Tom Watkins, the president of Murray McMurray Hatchery in Webster City, Iowa, which sells about 3 million chicks a year to people across the U.S. Typically, the hatchery has its sales lined up a few weeks in advance. But this year, Watkins says they're sold out through October, the end of the season.
That's 40 weeks of chickens that are pre-sold. We have literally sold them, you know, counted them before they hatched. So
to be clear, even with the record high prices of eggs at the grocery store this year, you can expect to shell out more to keep the chickens. For example, in March, the average cost of a dozen eggs was $6.23. A person who bought a carton every week for a year at that price would spend about $320. However, Katie Bell, an agriculture educator with the University of Illinois Extension, says that all the supplies needed for chickens, like the coop and the fencing to protect them against predators, would cost more than that.
You could easily spend $500 before you even get the birds.
And that goes for renting chickens, too. In St. Louis, Emily and Tom Schnitzer opened 4 feathered hens at the beginning of this year. Their rental packages start at $95 per month for a year-long commitment. Emily says their most expensive package at $190 a month includes full care of the birds.
We'll come out, we'll feed the chickens, we'll change out the bedding in the coop, make sure everything is going smoothly, just so it's pretty much the family only has to collect the eggs.
Katie Hitt is renting from the Schnitzers. Her family is caring for the chickens themselves. Hitt says her kids are picky eaters, but they want to eat the eggs from their chickens.
This is like, oh, I know my chicken. You know, they're already deciding whose chicken is who. My chicken laid this one. I'm going to eat that one. And so it's really, really cute.
Hitt's not sure yet if she'll keep the chickens after the year is up, but for now, she's enjoying the experience. For NPR News, I'm Skylar Rossi in Columbia, Missouri.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It is 4:18. Thank you for listening to All Things Considered on KAXC. Here we know local matters. We bring you updates on news and events relative to our rural communities. We do this because we live here too. Federal funding helps make this kind of local coverage possible, and that is at risk right now. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org to share what KAXC brings to our community with our legislatures. And thank you for listening. It's time for our daily dose of phenology.
On today's date, June 17, 2002, I come across a snapping turtle laying her eggs today. June is the month when the turtles come up and lay their eggs, both the snapping turtle and the painted turtle. Typically, it begins the first of the month and can run through early July. It seldom runs later than that because it takes about 80 days for those eggs to mature and develop. The snapping turtle can lay 50 to 60 eggs. The female painted turtle might lay 10 to 12 eggs. The snapping turtle simply can hold more eggs. Once the eggs are in the ground, it's just a matter of keeping the predators away. There's a host of animals that would love to have a nice turtle egg omelet, But if the turtles survive the gauntlet of skunks and raccoons, they will emerge in August or September and march off toward the nearest body of water where one would hope their travails were behind them. Such is not the case. There are plenty of dangers that lie in wait, but they are long-lived animals, and only a few need to make it to ensure the survival of the species.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Investigators are still determining the motive behind the killing of a Minnesota state representative and her husband over the weekend. They say that Vance Belter had a much larger list of people he was apparently planning to target, including other Democratic elected officials and abortion rights supporters. One area of his background is yielding some insight into the views he held about abortion, and that is his religious connections. NPR's domestic extremism correspondent, Odette Youssef, is here to discuss. Hi, Odette.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, so what do we know about his religious connections, his religious background?
We know that he graduated from a school in Texas called the Christ for the Nations Institute, which has put out a statement condemning the violence and saying it's not what the school teaches. But the CFNI is considered to be a precursor to a movement that is now referred to as the New Apostolic Reformation. And we know that when Belter was in Africa 2 years ago, he spoke during sermons about his belief in modern-day prophets and apostles in the U.S., and experts say this is distinct to NAR theology. And so, you know, now the NAR up until recently has been considered a fringe strand of the evangelical right. It's a neo-charismatic expression of Christianity.
Okay.
But, you know, a really important aspect of the NAR movement, Mary Louise, is its political aspirations. There's an idea they espouse called dominionism, and that is a belief that they are called to take control over every aspect of society to impose Old Testament biblical governance. And so this has been a powerful anti-democratic movement that has aligned itself with the MAGA movement and has also fed concerns about rhetoric that could inspire extremist violence.
Okay, a lot to take in there. You're talking about this has fed concerns about rhetoric, could inspire extremist violence. Is there evidence that that would actually give cause for concern that this faith community might turn to violence?
Well, some leading figures within the NAR were critical in mobilizing and fomenting anger within Trump's base in the period leading to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. But in the context of these attacks in Minnesota, you have to look at the language and framing around the topic of abortion. Fred Clarkson from Political Research Associates says there's reason to be concerned that the NAR is priming the pump for this kind of violence.
There's been a decided uptick in the rhetoric and vision of violence in the United States from apostolic leaders for some time.
And within that rhetoric, Mary Louise, you'll hear abortion discussed as ritual child sacrifice and as something that empowers demons.
Can we connect this, though? Can we connect extreme rhetoric with the violence we just saw in Minnesota?
So we know that Belter railed against abortion in America during at least one sermon abroad, so it was an issue he cared about. And there was an interesting detail in the federal complaint filed against Belter yesterday, which said that he sent a group text to his wife and other family members a few hours after the rampage occurred, and it said, "Dad went to war last night." This language of war is the language that the NAR uses when talking about taking dominion over society. Clarkson says it's clear who the enemies are in that war.
The NAR views historic Christian churches and civil government and its leaders as enemies, as, you know, infested with demons. These are things that they talk about all the time. The question is, at what point does the rhetoric meet the reality?
So in a sentence, Odette, is the case here that the rhetoric met the reality?
I think it's hard to say at this point, Mary Louise, but we will be learning more as the investigation continues.
That's NPR's Odette Youssef. Thank you.
Thank you.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of the release of Jaws, a movie that terrified generations of beachgoers. And in honor of that anniversary, this week our friends at WNYC's Radio Lab are exploring the science of sharks. Here is a small slice of that featuring Radio Lab co-host Lulu Miller and reporter Rachel Cusick.
Like, Lulu, if you had to guess for 2024, last year, do you want to guess like how many people died from shark attacks around the world?
How many people died?
Yes.
I don't know, like maybe 970.
Okay, so take that number and subtract 963.
Seven people. Singular people.
Seven confirmed fatalities from sharks last year.
Okay.
So just to put that into perspective, these are a few of the things that will kill more humans than sharks every year.
Okay.
So at the beach alone, the things that are way more likely to get you at the beach are rip currents.
Water itself. Okay.
Skin cancer, huge one. And those are just at the beach.
Okay.
Zoom out a little bit.
Yeah.
Lightning strikes.
Are more than sharks?
Yeah. 24,000 people a year, apparently. Selfies.
That's so sad.
It's a really bad way to go.
Okay. So you're saying like...
Wait, sorry. One more.
Yep.
The one stat that I just love as a New Yorker is that you are 10 times more likely to be bitten by a New Yorker than you are to be bitten by a shark.
I kind of believe that. I get that. Okay.
Yes.
Sharks, man. Like, they are so fast and so big. And, like, I can hear these statistics, but if we're at the beach and you tell me there are sharks in the water, I'm not going to go in. Could it be analogous to a snake kind of fear where it's just like, or I don't happen to have it, but a spider fear where it's like we come out ready to be afraid of these things because it would have served us?
Yeah. Well, according to the scientist I spoke to named Chris Lowe,
professor of marine biology and the director of the shark lab at Cal State Long Beach.
That is totally true for some animals.
They're land animals that we co-evolve with that we have innate fear.
But not for sharks.
Psychologists have done studies where they've shown babies pictures of snakes and spiders and they react with fear. Then they show them a picture of a shark and there's no reaction.
Chris pointed out the obvious fact that
we're not an aquatic animal.
For most of human history, people had very few interactions with sharks.
It was this beast that people were told about that they rarely get to see.
And Chris says, when all you have are stories,
what happens is it allows people's imaginations to take over.
Like, we didn't have goggles until like the 1950s. So we knew that things were taking us. We never actually ever saw these creatures. Like, the most we might see is the fin.
We're given a few pieces of information, and then we begin to develop this image of what these animals are like. We make the monster in our head.
And making the monster in our head, that's exactly what made Jaws a perfect horror movie.
You really didn't see a shark very often.
You get an hour into the film without seeing a shark.
And I think that was actually the brilliance of the movie.
All you get is that iconic score.
Radiolab's Lulu Miller and Rachel Cusick talking sharks this week in honor of the 50th anniversary of the movie Jaws. For more wild stories about sharks that glow, sharks that fly, and sharks that might even be able to cure cancer, swim on over to your podcast app and check out Radiolab.
Swimming. It's NPR News.
It's 4:29. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, we'll have National Native News. And at 4:45, a new feature. It's North Star Stories, produced by Ampers. News stories from communities throughout Minnesota. Support comes from the Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help 211 and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to residents of any age who are in crisis. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. And we thank North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Slight chance of showers this afternoon, partly to mostly sunny with highs in the upper 70s. Our lows tonight in the mid 50s, and for tomorrow, partly sunny. Again, a chance of showers in the afternoon, highs near 78.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bowles, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes recently received grants from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports, other housing-related funding for the tribes is a little less certain.
Tribes across the country receive federal support through the annual Indian Housing Block Grant. This year, the Eastern Shoshone tribe got about $2.3 million, and the Northern Arapaho tribe received about $3.6 million. Amaria LeBeau is the director of the Northern Arapaho Housing Authority.
We get this block grant based on a formula, right? And so it's based off the units and our need.
The money keeps housing authorities operating and helps maintain their current housing. Trump's proposed budget would decrease that funding by about 20%. An earlier draft also called for eliminating a competitive community development grant. Gilbert Ritchie is with the Eastern Shoshone Housing Authority and says losing that would have a direct impact on future projects.
That's the primary funding source for us to spearhead new housing development.
Congress is still in the process of reviewing the budget. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Last month, President Trump announced plans to reopen and rebuild Alcatraz, one of America's most infamous prisons that was shut down 6 decades ago. For now, it's a federal historic landmark managed by the National Park Service. Several top leaders from the Bureau of Prisons, including engineers, recently toured Alcatraz to conduct site assessments. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the 22-acre island within the San Francisco Bay has strong ties to the Hopi tribe of Arizona.
First a pre-Civil War fort, then a military prison, this maximum security federal penitentiary housed some of the nation's most notorious inmates from Al Capone to George Machine Gun Kelly. But Matthew Sakayestawa, a history professor at the University of Arizona, says they all had one thing in common.
The federal government has always seen that island as a place to put problematic people, including a group of 19 Hopi men.
Some refer to them as the Hopi 19, hailing from the Pueblo village of Oribe, perched atop Third Mesa in the high desert of northern Arizona. The Hopis were charged with sedition after refusing to let their children attend Indian boarding schools. With no due process since they were considered wards of the state, the then Commissioner of Indian Affairs sentenced the Hopi 19 to confinement and hard labor in 1895, nearly 1,000 miles away.
You will encounter steep walkways, uneven surfaces, and tripping hazards on Alcatraz Island. Please watch your step.
Right now, it's a park. This is a place for the public. I've taken a ferry boat trip there, less than 2 miles from the shore, and you can learn about this native history.
Sikayestawa, who is Hopi, says Alcatraz Island is also a political symbol.
Whether that's federal government's perspective or also from indigenous people.
And for President Donald Trump, Alcatraz is not only a symbol of law and order.
It's a big hulk that's sitting there rusting and rotting, but it sort of represents something that's both horrible and beautiful and strong and miserable, weak.
Tune in tomorrow for part two of this series on Alcatraz's ties to the Hopi. And on this day in 1876, the Battle of the Rosebud took place in eastern Montana between 4,000 Lakota Sioux warriors and General George Crook's troops. He lost 28 out of 1,300 men, but the greater disaster, the Battle of Little Bighorn, was 8 days away. I'm Brian Bull for National Native News.
Now.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Skugdash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nien. Support by Arctic Encounter 2025, an Arctic policy and business event July 30th to August 1st that explores community resilience, critical infrastructure, and traditional knowledge. Registration at arcticencounter.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. As more young people leave rural America, many communities there are aging. That can mean increased social isolation for older adults who stay. So one small town in Kansas is testing a new strategy for boosting quality of life across generations. Rose Conlin of member station KMUW has the story.
The Logan Manor doesn't sound like your typical nursing home. That's because it's also a school. The town of Logan, with a population of less than 500, recently welcomed nursing home residents and students into its new intergenerational facility called the Life Center. By bringing different age groups together under the same roof, administrators hope to foster connection and learning across generations.
Betty, are you doing a staring contest?
Inside, Betty Albright, age 90, is making May Day baskets with three of her friends. Jensen, who's 12, Harper and Harper, who are both 11.
Betty, are we on?
Yeah.
No, we are.
You're on.
Yeah. You're on.
I have a good time with those three. I always do because...
Do you want to sit with us next time,
I love them very much.
The setup lets nursing home residents volunteer in classrooms and help with science projects. And it provides learning opportunities for kids. One class is interviewing residents and recording their life stories. High schoolers can job shadow physical therapists and speech-language pathologists.
Llama, llama. Feels so new.
Right.
Down the hall, 6-year-old Rhett is practicing his reading with 63-year-old Tom Gosha.
Building a castle out of blocks. Making a rock from block.
A rock.
Box.
A rock.
From a box.
There you go.
Gosha has pulmonary fibrosis, and he's lived in the nursing home for 5 years. He's a favorite among the kids.
My nieces and nephews are all grown and gone, and they've got kids of their own, but they're in Imperial, Nebraska, Texas, and Omaha. So it's fun to have the little ones around.
7-year-old Rowan says Tom is always willing to discuss one really important topic.
I just like talking to him because he always wants to know about dinosaurs. There's a new dinosaur that I got called a Cicania. So like whenever he roars, he goes...
The Life Center is the brainchild of school principal David Kirkendall. He says not everyone was initially on board.
I've had some people express concern about if this is taking away from the classroom learning.
But he says having the residents around actually adds to kids' learning.
For example, I have a kindergarten grandson, and he can read at the fourth grade level. He can read to a resident at the fourth grade level while the teacher's working with some other students on primary reading aspects.
He thinks Logan could be a model for other communities trying to improve well-being. Teresa McComb, the nursing home's administrator, says she's already seen benefits in the 36 adults who live here.
Even residents that are unable to verbalize how much they like the kids coming over, their faces light up, they smile, they're just in better moods.
The National Council on Aging and other researchers say social contact associated with intergenerational programming can improve mental health in older adults. And Shannon Jarrett, a social work professor at Ohio State University, says children also have a lot to gain.
It builds knowledge about aging, it builds empathy about older adults, and it can have a positive impact on how these young people experience and head into old age themselves. And we know that adolescents have as high or higher levels of loneliness as older people do.
There are also challenges, like how to keep residents safe during flu season and how to maintain relationships over summer break. Administrators say they're more than willing to sort out those details to keep a program so beneficial to young students and the elderly going. For NPR News, I'm Rose Conlin in Logan, Kansas.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Jason Reynolds writes young adult novels that don't talk down to kids. His latest book is an audio-only release called Soundtrack, which follows a group of teenagers in New York.
They're all musicians, and they use this music to sort of build family amongst each other as they tour underground, physically underground in the New York City subway system. You know, and it's just an homage to New York City, an homage to young musicians. And it's an homage to what I believe is our most potent form of self-expression, which is music.
On this week's Wild Card, Jason Reynolds talked with host Rachel Martin about his own childhood.
How easily do you cry?
If the ASPCA commercials come on, you're going to... Let me say something. The moment I see them dogs... And that,
I don't know why I'm laughing. They are very sad.
I can't help it. I am a crybaby of all crybabies.
Are you a crier?
It is my favorite thing about myself.
Why?
Because it reminds me that the expectations of masculinity didn't get me. That I avoided it. That somehow, some way, I was able to maintain a sense of freedom. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. And there are moments in which perhaps it puts me in precarious and embarrassing situations, but the people who love me and the people who are around me understand me well enough to know that he's going to need a moment to get this out, and that's it. There's nothing to talk about. I have no problem crying publicly in front of audiences of people because I don't mind telling people that I appreciate folks bearing witness to a man who is able to somehow remain free. I'm grateful for it. I really, really, really am. And I'm grateful for my mother and father for my friends that I grew up with who are still my same friends today for allowing me space to be myself without forcing me into a box that I do not belong in. So, yes.
I love that as the mother of two boys.
Yeah.
I love it. And I wanna lift that up, and it's hard. It's hard to be a kid. It's hard to be a boy.
Oh, my God. Tell me about it. But this is the reason why I am grateful to have writing. I can put it somewhere, right? And that's what it did for me when I was 10. That's the reason I started writing in the first place. It's because my mom was crying. I was okay. I mean, I was going through what I was going through with my dad, but it was my mom who was hurting. And I was trying to figure out how to make her feel better. And that's the reason I started to write poems for her, to try to figure out how to help her. Right? Mm-hmm. So I think as long as, you know, it's important for people like us to just make sure we have a canister for this. We have to put it somewhere. And then, you know, we'll be able to manage our health differently.
You can watch that full conversation by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. And you can listen to Jason Reynolds' new audiobook Soundtrack now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:44. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers. It's news stories from communities throughout Minnesota. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region, produced by the KAXE news team. Support for KAXE comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Blast Wi-Fi, featuring Wi-Fi 6 technology to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here. The Edge of the Wilderness Discovery Center in Marcel hosts a Kids Fishing Day Saturday, June 28th from 8:30 to noon. Learn about boat and water safety, fish from the pier, and take part in casting contests. Each child should bring a life jacket if they have one, otherwise a limited number will be available. Let us know what's going on in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's stories, the state ramps up oversight of autism and housing support programs. Then, shocked by the military-like presence by federal agents earlier this month, some in Minneapolis are still demanding answers. And a school in Winona is getting a new indoor athletic complex. I'm Gracie J. The Minnesota Department of Human Services is placing tougher screening requirements on Medicaid-backed providers of autism and housing services. The providers are now under the high-risk category. That means owners will have mandated fingerprinting, screening visits before enrollment in Medicaid, and unannounced site visits. The change comes after a federal investigation of two autism centers in the state last year. Just last month, a report found DHS has 40 active fraud investigations into housing stabilization providers. Next, when federal agents used what appeared to be a strong military-like force to serve search warrants earlier this month in Minneapolis, it left a lasting impression in the community. Reporter McFinnigan takes us to some community meetings where residents are still searching for answers.
Federal officials are now saying the discovery of 900 pounds of methamphetamine with a street value of more than $22 million is what prompted agents to raid a Mexican restaurant in South Minneapolis on June 3rd. The military-style operation caused immediate protests from community members who feared a raid by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Some protesters witnessed ICE badges on officers' uniforms.
No one's negating the fact that there's a need to attend to criminal activity. We see it here all the time. We know. We don't want drugs on our street.
Pastor Gerald Osorto serves this community at St. Paul San Pablo Lutheran Church.
We need leaders that are able to respond with integrity now, not later in the future, in order to prevent a future where masked officials with assault rifles becomes normalized and where we begin to accept that that kind of terror is okay.
Community members were surprised to see Minneapolis police and Hennepin County sheriffs assisting federal agents.
I've never quite believed Minneapolis's separation ordinance. There's a careful choice in wording when I hear some of our elected officials talk about what they're not willing to do and what they're required to do, and I put that in quotes.
Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara shared concerns about the federal show of force.
I think the manner in which some of it was handled was tone deaf for the situation.
Hennepin County Sheriff Dewana Witt said that while she feels the feds could have handled it differently, she raised concerns about protesters disrupting the operation.
Right now, we need the community's help. We need the media's help in making sure that you support these people that are continuing to show up to combat the people that are trying to harm our communities.
Other community members witnessed agents using excessive force against protesters that day. Minneapolis City Council member Jason Chavez, who represents the area, said he's taking steps to protect his community, which has a large population of immigrants and people of color.
You saw scare tactics being descended upon our community, and this has just caused a very traumatic incident for many of the people that live there.
Chavez prompted City Council to investigate the police department's involvement in the event. He says the community needs that transparency to build back trust.
I think it's important to figure out what breakdown in communication happened. What was the city's role in it, and make this information publicly available so our residents know what happened, what went wrong, and what needs to change in the future. And we're going to get that report back when the city auditor is done with this work by July 31st.
I want accountability that doesn't deflect to what the federal government did.
For North Star Stories, I'm Mick Finnegan.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Students at Cotter School in Winona will soon have a new place to work out. Cotter purchased a former dormitory from Winona State University. Thanks to a generous donation, they plan to tear it down and build a new indoor athletic complex in its place. The new facility will include turf and hard surfaces, a walking track, as well as year-round space for student athletics and community recreation. Cotter says the project is a major investment in student wellness and Winona's broader needs for indoor sports facilities.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Charleston, South Carolina is remembering one of the nation's most heinous hate crimes. Today marks 10 years since a white supremacist killed 9 black worshipers during Bible study at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church. NPR's Debbie Elliott returned to Charleston to hear how people are reflecting a decade later.
That's a familiar and somber sound in downtown Charleston as Emmanuel AME's Gothic bell tower rings out daily at 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. There's a chime for each of the victims, known as the Emmanuel Nine.
It seems like yesterday. It's still fresh in many of our minds and in our hearts.
That's Charleston City Councilman William Dudley Gregory, part of the Emmanuel congregation.
Our family has been a member of that church for probably in the 1800s, way back. I can remember, you know, sitting on that fifth row with my mother. I mean, I grew up in that church.
Known as Mother Emmanuel for its role in establishing the AME faith, the church is the oldest black congregation in the South, dating to slavery. So there was no mistaking this symbolism when in 2015, white supremacist Dylan Roof, intent on stoking a race war, pulled out a gun after being welcomed into Wednesday night Bible study. He shot and killed 9 worshipers as they bowed their heads in prayer. Among them was the church's pastor, the Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who was a South Carolina state senator. 5 others survived. Roof is now on federal death row. Gregory says his plan backfired.
The city of Charleston is the seat of the Confederacy. For that to happen in this city, a very hateful person planning a race riot to divide didn't happen in this city. In fact, I think it brought us as a people closer together.
Over the last 10 years, the city of Charleston has taken steps toward racial reconciliation, issuing a formal apology for slavery in what was one of the busiest ports of the slave trade, and establishing a commission to promote equity and inclusion. Gregory says the city is getting there, but the work is not done. He says African Americans have long suffered and sacrificed to bring about racial progress in America.
It's not minorities or African Americans that have to change. It's white people. White people have to change. They control the narrative, the dialogue.
The Emmanuel congregation has long been a part of the story of race in America. The church was destroyed and more than 30 members were executed in the 1820s for planning a slave rebellion. The racist attack 10 years ago is yet another tragedy that Emmanuel has to overcome, says current pastor Eric Manning.
We, as the church, still experience trauma.
Manning has been the pastor here since the year after the massacre, and it's been a difficult journey for the congregation.
We have the motto, we are a light in the pathway of darkness, and we embrace that. But in this season, at the same token, we have to remember that Mother Emmanuel is resilient. Gone through a lot, continue to go through a lot, but the church continues to move forward.
Part of that is creating a new space for reflection.
Watch your step.
Reverend Manning leads me out a side door of the church basement where the killings occurred.
As you come in, this is the memorial courtyard area.
It's flanked by two elongated white marble benches. A water fountain is being installed in the middle that will be inscribed with the names of the Emmanuel Nine. It's designed by Michael Arad, architect of the September 11th Memorial in New York. Manning says the idea is to present a crossroads where people can consider the stakes if hate is allowed to thrive.
And if we think of ourselves as travelers, there are certain key things that we should always try to embrace. One is the acknowledgement of racism, acknowledging the hatred therein, and then working towards a path of reconciliation.
There's a theme you hear time and time again from people touched by the Emmanuel massacre.
There is transformation out of tragedy.
That's the Reverend Sharon Risher, whose mother, Ethel Lee Lance, was among those killed. Risher says her mom was known for a lot of things.
Real perky, snazzy dresser, big smile, always wanting to help.
Risher says she went down a dark hole after the slayings, carrying anger and bitterness that she has now channeled into activism.
This ministry I call now of politics, this ministry of social justice, is something that have grown out of that tremendous pain.
10 years later, she's still pushing South Carolina to pass a hate crime law and lobbying Congress to close the background check loophole that allowed the shooter to buy a gun despite previous drug arrests. Risher says she would have expected to see more progress by now.
Being Black in America is just a challenge anyway. And the whole thing behind what happened was hate. And we continue to deal with this.
Other family members also find solace in speaking out against hate.
My name is Melvin L. Graham Jr. I'm the brother of Cynthia Graham Hurd. When she was executed, I made a promise to be her voice.
Cynthia Hurd, a librarian, was at the church that night working on a poster outlining Emmanuel's rich history when a friend asked her to stick around for Bible study. Melvin Graham says the root of the tragedy has been a problem throughout history, not being able to see others as human.
They're not people. They're different. They're expendable.
He sees that kind of thinking in today's debate over immigration and calls it a vicious cycle.
In the past, it was Blacks and African Americans that was the cause of all the problems. Now it's Hispanics that are the cause of all the problems. Who's next? And that's what scares me the most.
Back at Emmanuel, Reverend Manning is readying for a busy week of memorial events at the church. The congregation is in the world spotlight now. Worship services draw celebrities, international visitors, and tour groups. He wants them to leave Charleston with this message.
Love is stronger than hate, and we are not going to let hate have the final say.
Manning says 10 years after June 17, 2015, is a time to both reflect and find a way to ensure this kind of tragedy never happens again. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Charleston.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It is a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. Coming up at 7, On the River, it's a great mix of music. Your volunteer host tonight is Sarah Sarah. Slight chance of showers this evening and partly cloudy overnight, lows in the mid-50s, and tomorrow partly sunny, chance of showers in the afternoon, highs near 78. You can learn